Up next is a piece from CGSF public affairs contributor Xenia Choiko, who interviewed SFU's Richard Frank about cybercrime and this interesting system that he developed called the Dark Crawler. So we're going to go to that right now.
So my name is Richard Frank. I'm a professor here in the School of Criminology, and all my research and my classes and students, everything focuses on computer crime.
Can you explain the concept of principal component analysis and how it is applied to identify key nodes in networks associated with child exploitation?
The general approach, I'm assuming you took these questions out of one of the papers.
Yeah.
The idea of the paper was to incorporate the amount of images and content on the network as opposed to just their position in the network. And also to see which nodes are the most important in terms of if you remove them, you disconnect the network. So that's where the principal component analysis would come in, is it would help us find the nodes which are important, and if you were to remove them, would splinter the network into as many pieces as possible.
Mm.
So the idea is you're browsing around on this content, child exploitation content, you find one website, you browse around, it has links to some other websites, you click on it, so you visit some other and some other. If you were to, you as the attacker or police, if you can remove some of these websites, then that browsing won't be possible because you won't be able to reach as far away. You would encounter broken links, that sort of thing. Make the content harder to discover.
Okay. What advantages do these PCA algorithms offer over traditional attack methods like hubs, bridges, and network capital?
It's a different approach. You could argue hubs are important. We argue that splintering the network would yield the biggest benefit in terms of disrupting the network.
And in what ways did PCA underscore A and PCA underscore L prove more effective than established attack methods in targeting child exploitation networks?
So typically, for example, police would go after websites or websites that contain a lot of content,
mm-hmm.
which is important. We were looking at how to disrupt the network. So someone visiting and looking for this content would have a very difficult time in finding new websites and new places for this content. So these two matrices would help in terms of disrupting that discovery of new content.
And could the success of these algorithms be replicated in networks outside of child exploitation, such as drug trafficking or human smuggling?
The approach is not dependent on this being a child exploitation network. Any network where the goal is you want to disrupt and segregate the network into as many splinter components as possible,
mm-hmm.
would have the same benefit.
Okay. And the study suggests that PCAL was particularly effective in isolating critical nodes. Could you elaborate on the structural significance of these nodes?
I would need to have a look at the paper.
Mm-hmm.
If I recall correctly, isolates those components or those nodes, websites that are completely isolated after you remove some of the websites that we target, those would be impossible to discover, essentially,
mm-hmm.
Which was one of the goals of the method that we're proposing.
And how might law enforcement agencies leverage this insight to disrupt online child exploitation networks?
So their goal has been to remove high-profile targets, which is great. But those don't necessarily live in isolation. There might be other websites that draw visitors to that, which might be more important. You could cause more damage to the entire ecosystem if you removed websites that drive traffic to your current target. So it's a different way of prioritizing.
And are there any potential legal or ethical concerns when deploying these algorithms in sensitive investigations?
When we started this project, the first thing we did was we talked to the Integrated Child Exploitation Unit of the RCMP here in, it was in Surrey, because we didn't want to get into legal trouble. Mm-hmm. We didn't want to be arrested and for accessing this type of content. But instead of them, they told us some guidelines, but instead of them discouraging the entire research, they actively encouraged it. One of the exceptions to our child exploitation laws here in Canada is for academic purposes. So mm-hmm. we as researchers, for research purposes, can access this. The crawler that we used was developed so that humans will need to look at this content. Mm-hmm. And the police gave us a hash database, or like a fingerprint of images. So if we encountered an image, we could fingerprint it, compare it to their database, and without looking at it, determine if it's child exploitation content.
And with the dark crawler, it was used to gather over 150 million posts related to violent extremist activities. What were some of the key findings from this data collection?
Data set has been used for many different studies, not just right-wing, but also incel-based research. Mm-hmm. Some of the things that we've looked at were trying to identify the same ideas for the child exploitation content, trying to target, like identify the best targets. Police would have a limited amount of resources. Targeting becomes really, really essential. So the idea was, if we can have a look at the entire community, can we identify people who are driving the narrative, who are radicalizing other people, for example. Mm-hmm. And if we can isolate people who are driving the topic, go after them. Those would be good targets. Alternatively, you could also go after people who are being radicalized. Let's say 2 years ago someone joined, then they started asking questions, very benign stuff. And then a year after, they started interacting with someone else, and then all of a sudden their conversations have become more extreme. And the more extreme and more extreme, is that person approaching sort of like an acting out phase, mm-hmm. in which case they could be physically violent, and those might be good targets. Mm-hmm. So that's roughly where the research that we worked on was.
Wow. And how does the data collected by the dark crawler inform our understanding of the communication strategies used by extremist networks?
A couple of different ways. For right wing, the communication seems to be somewhat benign, meaning they know they're fully aware of the language that will get them into trouble, mm-hmm. and they stay away from it. Mm-hmm. So picking up on these nuanced things tends to be quite difficult, because they know they're not supposed to talk about certain things, so they don't. In another community, the incel community, the involuntary celibates, they have specific code words which they use, and upon first reading, you probably won't know what those code words are and won't fully understand what the discussion is about.
I might kind of. I actually kind of looked into incels a bit.
Once you pick up the terminology, it's not that difficult, but once you pick up on the terminology, the conversation becomes much more obvious of mm-hmm. what they're talking about, and all the negativity and how they perceive women and a certain segment of the male population. But you need to build a code book, sort of either an actual document or in your mind, to be able to understand it. Does that answer the question?
With the incels, like, what were some of the like communication methods you managed to find with the Darkcrawler?
We would analyze the sentiment that they're talking about, the topics they're talking about. One of the other important things or topics in these communities is how they individuals can be de-escalated or de-radicalized. And one thing that we found was that any, especially in the incel community, any attempts at de-radicalization would very quickly get you kicked out. So they reject that content quite actively, which makes it very difficult to for whatever researchers, government, law enforcement, whatever, to go in and try to de-radicalize certain people. Mm-hmm. How they leave the community becomes very important because you want to draw people out of the community to make sure they're healthy.
And I'm assuming some of the communications you might have managed to find is like the code words that I know incels use is Chad's, Stacy's.
Yeah, those.
Yeah, those ones. Taking the red pill or the black pill, like those ones too.
Yes.
Is that what you guys managed to find?
We have an entire document with like 40 keywords on it or more. It's been a while since I've seen it, so it might be expanding. Yeah, they have their own terminology for these things.
Considering with the vast data set collected by the Darkcrawler, what challenges arise in terms of data privacy and ethical considerations?
So for ethics, for all the projects that we've done, we've gone through the ethics board. The line is relatively clear. We don't go after personal details. That is a privacy thing, it's an ethical thing, and we don't actually care about private details. We are looking at the aggregate. What is this community doing, not what is whatever John Doe doing in that community. So the privacy has been pretty clear. We don't collect private details, we're, again, looking at the aggregate in the entire community.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of what content we collect, we are able to collect anything that does not require any interaction. So we don't engage with the community, and also we don't use our personal details to log in, for example, to a website. So anything that requires that would be out of bounds,
mm-hmm.
off limits. Having said that, we've done studies on crypto markets where they sell drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And those do require logins, but the logins are a made-up username and password. So not tied to an email address or not tied to any personal details. And that has been okay to collect.
And how do researchers balance the need for comprehensive data collection with the potential for infringing on individual rights?
There are lots of studies that talk to individuals. We don't do that. We do talk to individuals, but the focus is on the entire community. We don't ever act as an arm of law enforcement or government, for example. We haven't done anything and don't intend to do anything at the request of police, for example.
Mm.
These are all academic research questions that we try to answer. We make sure that we don't violate anyone's privacy in the process.
And what measures are in place to prevent misuse of data obtained through such large-scale network analysis tools?
The data that we collect sits in IT services on a SFU managed machine. It's accessible through a website that's password protected. A couple of my researchers and my criminology class has access to, because I asked them to look at some of that content and analyze it for some of their course projects. The access they have, they have access to the entire data, but they can't siphon the data off the system.
Mm-hmm.
So they could read some of the content, but they can't mass download the entire database. Even if that were possible, the data that they would get would still essentially be a copy of what's freely available in some of these forms. I know the data could be misused to people collect social media content all the time and do facial profiling on them, and et cetera. We don't collect any images, we just collect the text.
Mm-hmm. And to close off, final question, with the dark crawler, which type of incels did you guys manage to find information on? Like, do you guys have like their names and like what they do? And like, did you guys like look into any other incels or like steady, more infamous incels?
We don't try to break anonymity. Mm-hmm. So if username Bob57 is online, we don't try to identify that person as to whether they're in Canada or Washington or whatever. Mm-hmm. So we don't. The goal is not to identify and put a name to that user. Again, the focus would be more on how does the community behave, what language do they use, how do they perceive whatever topic, and understand those things. There have been a couple of incels that have gone off and murdered people. We do know their usernames, so we can retroactively go back and see, are there any hints as to why this person acted out, or is there discussion before acting out different than everyone else in that community? And if so, how is it different? Meaning, can we differentiate certain people that are likely to act out? So that would be one question. But even if we found an incel murder, some people has a specific type of conversation online, and there are a couple of other people that are conversing in the same fashion, we wouldn't be going after their anonymity. It's not, we can't be the arm of law enforcement.
And would you consider like incels to be like a relatively new threat, or like how big of a threat do they pose to society in general?
In terms of the idea itself, I don't think it's a new idea.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the ability to connect to like-minded people, thanks to the internet, has made this community be a recognized community. People suddenly found others who are like-minded and then became encouraged by them.
Mm-hmm.
And hey, I'm not weird, quote unquote. There are other people that think exactly like I do, so I'm going to talk to them. The problem is then other perspectives get closed off, and they start to be radicalized and radicalized. But it's not, the idea I don't think is a new thing.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of whether they pose a threat or not, it's difficult to say if a person is in the community and then gets radicalized and poses a threat, or whether they will eventually pose a threat and that's why they're in the community.
Mm-hmm.
So they too could be, and like we are, correlated, but we don't know which causes which. Whether they act out and that's why they're in the thing, or they're in the thing and that's why they act out. So I don't know how dangerous that community is. Looking at the past, they have gone off and murdered people. At the same time, there are other communities that are much more violent. So I would say those are bigger threats.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for your time.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
Broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
This is CICK News. Spring has officially sprung in the Skeena region, and as bears are out of hibernation, they're looking for food right now. Spottings of the mystical Kermode or spirit bear have piqued the interest of many travelers along Highway 16 in Terrace and Kitimat, but Sergeant Neller is on the news to discuss what is safe and unsafe behavior when you're tempted to get a picture of bears. Kermode bears are a subspecies of the American black bear, A small portion of the population carry a gene that results in the iconic white or cream-colored coat. They habituate in the dense, lush coastal rainforests near Kitimat and even further east, closer to Terrace, along the Skeena River.
Yeah, my name is Micah Neller. I'm the sergeant for the Conservation Officer Service in Terrace.
Okay, great. So bears are awake, and this is the typical time of year where they are looking for food. Are you getting a lot of reports about that?
Yeah, the Conservation Officer Service, we're seeing an uptick in bear conflict complaints in pretty much all municipalities and habited areas by people. It's pretty normal this time of year. With bears coming out of hibernation, they're just looking for food.
Have there been more Komodo bear sightings this year?
Well, every year there's a few sightings. Komodo bears are fairly rare, so when one is sighted, it usually becomes a point of interest for people. And people become curious and they want to go out and have a look at the bears.
I understand why people are so interested in the Komodo bear, but is there a safe way that you would say that people can snap their photo of it? And I guess what are like the inherent dangers of if they're trying to be too adventurous, either on the highway or potentially on their own property?
Yeah, like we would rather not see people seeking out the bears, especially on the highway. People stopping on the highway causes a highway traffic hazard. As well, if people spend too much time on the highways, you can habituate the bears to vehicles, and then we put the bears in danger of being hit on the highway at some point. From what we've seen is if there's bears hanging around on the highways, either people become careless with their attractants or some people make the decision to actually put attractants down so they can get pictures of the bears, which is absolutely what we do not want to see happen.
Officer Neller, when is it time to call a conservation officer?
Yeah, what we'd like to see is if you do see a bear, any bear, Komodo or any bear on the roadway, and you make the decision to stop and take your picture, stop, take your picture, stay in your vehicle, leave your window rolled up and move on. And then as far as when it's time to call the Conservation Officer Service, if people are seeing behavior from other people or bears or wildlife that you know they're concerned with, they can phone our Rapline number at 1-877-952-7277. And our officers will make the decision on how we basically triage the calls and make the decision on how we respond to them. So if it's not something that's really concerning for us, we may not respond to it. But definitely if the complaints involve people feeding bears on the roadway, we will definitely be responding to that, following up with the complaints as well.
Do you roughly know the amount of bear sightings that you've had in the Terrace Kitimat area this year?
Kitimat seems to be, there's more bear activity in Kitimat than the other communities, and that's just a factor of where Kitimat is located. I can't really say an exact number, but the public can count on there's more bears around in the spring, obviously, because they're waking up from hibernation and they're wandering around trying to find food. And when they find, you know, attractants, food, human food, garbage, whatnot, they tend to hold in those areas, especially if they're able to access it. And we'd like to see people just have a general respect for wildlife. And if you see it on the highway, when I understand people are curious and they want to snap some pictures, and that's fine. I'll make sure where you're pulling off or whatnot is in a safe spot. But we definitely don't want to see people getting out of their vehicles and trying to approach the bears and yelling at them and tossing things to them, which affects their behavior. The bears are just feeding right now because they're trying to put some weight back on after losing it over the winter. So, you know, which is natural for them to be feeding on all this green matter that's growing right now. But what we're seeing is people exiting their vehicles and approaching them and trying to get these pictures of them. They yell at them or holler at them or toss things to them to try and get them to move or hold in one spot and that sort of thing. And you know, the end result of that is never good for the bear. And that's what our concern is at this point. Well, that starts by people just respecting the bears and respecting their space and snapping their photos and moving on, staying in their vehicles.
CSK News is funded by the Government of Canada, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and is a participating station in the Local Journalism Initiative. On behalf of my colleague Dan Messick and myself, Pam Hassan, thanks for listening.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. your alternative to mainstream media. Broadcasting from Simon Fraser University at Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
This is a CGY News update. June is Pride Month, and a local bird enthusiast is encouraging people to not only celebrate pride in the community, but also out in nature. Madison Wagner is a local bird enthusiast passionate about teaching people about the interesting and sometimes strange life of native birds in the area. It was when she was going to school at Vancouver Island University, majoring in biology and specializing in ecology, where she found her passion for looking at animal behavior, particularly bird behavior.
We really started birding during the pandemic. Couldn't really go outside and do things, so, you know, you can do this in your backyard, and I really got into it. So went from knowing no birds to about like 200 overnight. And I'm definitely not a pro by any means. The title is more just to get people out with me, but I am pretty good about all the birds in the area. So
Wagner has been offering bird walks through the city of Nanaimo for about a year. During the walks, she showcases the different species of birds in the area for interested community members and already established bird watchers, also known as birders. CHY met with Wagner at Buttertubs Marsh Park to talk about why she wants to encourage more queer people into the hobby. As the Marsh is a bird and wildlife sanctuary, the place is a bird watcher's paradise, and where Wagner does her bird walks.
Yeah, there's a lot of red-winged blackbirds flying around. They're just all over the place. They nest in all the reeds. I can hear some common yellowthroat singing. They kind of make like a witchety-witchety-witchety call. That's about it right now. It's kind of late in the day. Right now, birding's best in the morning, but I work, so here we are. But yeah, there's definitely always like hummingbirds around. There's juncos around. There's song sparrows around. It is a great place to go birding because of the marsh.
She says about 30 different species of birds can be found in the marsh, including different types of animals, such as beavers, deer, and turtles. For Pride Month, Wagner wants to encourage more people a part of the 2SLGBTQIA+ community to try out birding for themselves.
Well, it's one of these hobbies that I feel like anyone can do. You kind of just go out in nature and look for things. And it's really kind of right now, unfortunately, like a very white person activity. Typically older too. You'll mostly see older people birding, and I really just would like to get more people out birding. It is a very accessible hobby to have. And yeah, I think that's mostly the reasons why, but I just thought it'd be nice to make more community in Nanaimo as well.
Wagner says other communities like Victoria and Vancouver have queer birding groups where members can be themselves without judgment.
I just feel like there is a need for more queer people outdoors. I feel like there's been a lot of people who feel like, you know, they can't exist in these spaces. And a lot of my friends are queer and into nature, and I kind of want to make that bubble a bit bigger. You know, I think there's kind of like a stereotype of people knitting and crocheting and baking and being queer, and I just want some like outdoor STEM people as well. And there definitely is people out in Nanaimo looking for that.
Also for Pride Month, Wagner wants to highlight the more queer side of nature.
Western gulls, we have them out here. Gulls are incredibly hard to identify, but Western gulls are known to be in same-sex relationships. You know, there's a lot of female Western gulls who only mate with males to fertilize the egg, and then they go back to their female lover and they raise that egg together.
Wagner says she hopes during this month, people a part of the 2SLGBTQIA+ community will step out of their comfort zones and take part in new hobbies or communities that haven't already been known as queer spaces.
I think hobbies can be enjoyed by everyone at this point. Like, you know, pickleball was more of an older person sport, and now it's been really like everyone does pickleball now. And so I think birding should be the next pickleball.
For CHY News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This report was made with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs podcast, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.
Every Friday from 1 to 2 p.m., tune in to Department Uno to hear the latest and greatest from the CJSF playlist, featuring all new music from local, Canadian, and international artists. fresh releases from the music department every week on Department Uno, only on CJSF 90.1 FM.